This is Robert Miller, Executive Director of the National Fragile X Foundation, and this is a National Fragile X Foundation podcast for your benefit. Today's title is Maximizing the Educational Experience for Children with Fragile X Syndrome by Developing an Appropriate Individualized Education Plan. And we are honored to have two special guests with us today. The first person is Dr. Vicki Sudfalter, who has been involved in Fragile X work for more than 25 years and specializes on research into language, gaze aversion, hypoarousal problems, many, many important areas of the development of individuals with Fragile X syndrome. Vicki works at the New York State Institute for Basic Research in Developmental Disabilities. She's part of the Fragile X Clinic there at that site in New York. She was also a recipient in 2006 of the National Fragile X Foundation's Jared Cole Clinician Award for service to families with Fragile X syndrome. She's a member of the National Fragile X Foundation's Advisory Committee. And she has published many articles, spoken at many conferences, and is a renowned expert on many areas, including today's topic on IEPs. So we're very pleased to have you, Vicki. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And we have Jane Dixon Weber also on the line. Jane is the Support Services Coordinator for the National Fragile X Foundation, has been so for many years, and talks to thousands of parents on the phone and in email and in conference presentations. Jane is also the parent of a 23-year-old son with Fragile X syndrome, so she certainly has been at the table for many IEPs over the years. And my own background includes special education, teaching, and administration. And I have been at hundreds of IEPs representing schools earlier in my career. So you have three people here today speaking on who are experienced in IEPs, and we're going to have a conversation and see how we can make the IEP process the most beneficial for you and your child or children. So, Vicki, let me just start with you, since you are our primary guest here today. What is it about IEPs that makes them sometimes so controversial?
Well, in my opinion, one of the things that make them controversial is that sometimes the pedagogical staff does not always make all of its...
Can you define pedagogical for our listeners, please? That's okay.
Yes, of course. The teachers and the therapists that are sitting at the table don't always make all of their findings and recommendations crystal clear to the parents. According to the guidelines, the parents should receive in advance of the IEP the recommendations for therapies, the recommendations for class placement, so that when they go to the table, when they go to the IEP table, the parent understands where the Board of Ed's goals are, and they can go in with their own agendas, which may be in accordance with what the Board of Ed wants, but maybe not in accordance with what the Board of Ed wants. Frequently, at least to the IEP meetings that I've gone to, the parent is confronted with what the Board of Ed wants and is asked to approve it, not approve it, usually not given the option to not approve it. And it's, for many parents, it becomes very anxiety-provoking that they seem to feel that they have to make decisions right on the spot. They don't always understand what the evaluations found about their child. They don't understand the implications of the evaluations, that if the child performed in a certain way, that would enable him to a certain amount of therapy. If the child performed in another way, it would suggest another form of therapy. So what is controversial is that, A, the parent is put on the spot in many cases. B, the parent sometimes is not given the time to explicate his or her own desires for what should be part of the IEP, part of the goals for the child. And they're not always explained all of the implications. And so at the end of the day, or at the end of the meeting, the parent walks away not being completely sure about what happened and what their child is going to get. I get parents at my table, at my evaluation table, who I'll ask them, how did this happen? And they'll look and go, I don't know. So that, for me, that is probably one of the most controversial parts of the IEP process, that it is not transparent to the parents.
Jane, does that resonate with some of your experience?
Well, and I think absolutely it does. And then I think when you couple that with parents who don't have, in many cases, even a basic understanding of the IEP and all of its components, that it becomes so overwhelming to parents, they feel like they're attending, kind of like a show where they're being told something. And in some cases, I've told parents, it is okay to go in with what goals and objectives you'd like to see worked on, and they're like, really? I need that? So, it's kind of an education process on both sides.
I think I owe our listeners a little bit more explanation. I started off by asking why these are so controversial, but I know for a fact that there are thousands of IEPs that go smoothly,
yes,
where the staff are dedicated, a heart, mind, and spirit to the well-being of the child and meeting the family's needs, and I don't want to forget that point.
I absolutely agree, Robbie. And you asked me the question, what makes it
right,
tough thing for the parents? I don't think that teachers necessarily go in trying to make it difficult for parents. I think what happens is we have a tremendously overworked staff, pedagogical staff. They have just a certain amount of time to get the IEP finished. They have many in a given day. So it's a cumbersome process at best. I don't mean to make it put all the blame on teachers and therapists, and no blame should go on teachers and therapists. I agree with Jane. Many times the parents don't realize that they can walk in with their own goals and objectives, and they have the right to ask to please let me see what is going to be the basis of my child's placement and my child's therapies. So once they ask for that information, they get it. And then it's a very different type of process where people know, and then people are prepared. People don't always know that they should be prepared, and then it becomes very anxiety provoking, and they walk out not knowing, realizing that they haven't asked for what they wanted, that they had other rights. Okay.
So, Vicki, I know that you had prepared your thoughts for today's call, and I don't want to get you sidetracked on that. So, but let me just kind of frame it up this way. What are the necessary ingredients for a successful IEP experience?
Well, it's different for children at different ages, but I think in general, and I'm going to speak specifically for children with Fragile X syndrome, because it probably is different for kids with autism and kids with other disabilities. But for children with Fragile X syndrome, I think what's crucial is that the teachers and the therapists understand the unique behaviors of children with Fragile X syndrome. And I think it's incumbent upon parents, it's incumbent upon the staff to understand that there are some very important phenotypic and behavioral characteristics that have to be appreciated when writing about the IEP.
Define phenotypic for us, please.
Phenotypic are those behaviors that characterize a particular group of people. So a phenotype, for instance, or a phenotypic behavior for, at least in my opinion, for a child with Fragile X would be his or her tendency toward hyperarousal. It would be his or her tendency to become perseverative in their speech. That means repeating over and over certain phrases, certain topics. The tendency to look away when anxious. So those are some of the defining characteristics of children, of individuals with Fragile X syndrome. And I think it's terribly important to begin with that parents demand that the staff that is writing the IEP or that to whom they're helping write the IEP be aware of these behaviors and take into account these behaviors when writing about the particular goals that will be part of the IEP. I think also parents should go in consultation with perhaps specialists in Fragile X. The National, do a magnificent service to help in terms of thinking about some of the issues of the people with Fragile X confront. So parents should go in also to the IEP with some goals that they want their child to meet. So, for instance, with a very young one, you may want to state that I want, in concert with myself, being the parent, I want the child to be able to gain some toileting skills. Many parents don't realize that in preschool and even in kindergarten, the parent can work with the teaching staff on toileting. They also may want to be able to have as part of the goal, part of the IEP goal, some self-help skills such as putting on a shirt or holding a fork in the correct way and feeding himself. So parents should know the types of goals that can be put into an IEP and have input into those goals. He should be thought about prior to the IEP meeting. And in terms of the special types of phenotypic considerations, meaning the behavioral considerations, you'd want there to be mention of the hyperarousal that individuals with Fragile X confront and will continue to confront all of their lives, and be able to decide what would be the appropriate strategies that teachers and therapists use to help the child self-regulate, to help the child calm, to help the child cope, and to help the child perform. And to talk about those strategies, to talk about proven strategies that it will add to the child's ability to learn. And I think lastly, of course this is a presentation that goes on for hours, but I think what's also tremendously important is to have the parent understand that indeed your child can learn. That what we want to do is we want to teach the child. That is exactly what we want to do. That your child will be able to learn, will be able to acquire many, many skills given that the behaviors of the child are understood and are dealt with appropriately, and that the environment is also appropriate for the child.
Okay. So let me ask you this, and this is a question for both of you. You're in the meeting, you're trying to maximize the educational experience, and for whatever reason, the human dynamics start to go south in the meeting. The staff, as you've already alluded to, can be, no matter how well-meaning, they're under their own pressures, time demands, lack of resources, pressure from the higher-ups in the school administration. And often we'll talk to parents, Jane, I know you talk to many parents about this and have been in this situation yourself, where you have to decide, do you become confrontational, or is there a different way to get the IEP process back on track so it really will maximize the educational experience?
I'll let Jane handle that first.
Okay, Jane?
What I learned very quickly, I mean, is a couple of things, that you're in this, you know, especially when you have a very young child, you will be working with the school district for close to 20 years, so it's in your best interest to learn how to try to work with the people. And also, I was surprised and pleased that the difference I felt and what I took from the staff too, when I brought someone else to the IEP with me. Bringing someone with a second set of ears, and they didn't always respond in the emotional way that I did, that helped. I found it extremely helpful, most helpful, when my husband could come with me. Now, and I know that's not possible for everyone, but bringing a friend can make a big difference on making sure that comparing notes with, did you hear that, what I heard kind of thing, because often that varies.
I have found, I go to many, many IEPs meetings for my clients with Fragile X syndrome, and I have found that if it becomes confrontational, I think what happens is the school feels that you're putting them on the spot and that you're telling them they don't know what they're doing. And what I usually do as the quote-unquote expert in Fragile X, I said, let me just view the classroom. Let me just see what's going on. And we can talk about some of the things I see that may help you teach the child more efficiently. And we all agree that we're all there. And in fact, we all are there to help the child learn. And if you just take a step back a bit, and for me, I can get pretty excited. My clients know that. So I usually have to do a lot of deep breathing and calming myself down before I go in, because I can get a little over aroused myself. But if we just take it away from being adversarial, and then we focus back on, well, all we really want to do is help this child learn. We want to help this kid become the adult we know he can be, live the adult life that his parents are hoping for and that would make him happy, and that's all we're doing. We're preparing this child for a productive, happy life, right? And everybody goes, sure. And then you say, okay, so then what we need is to see what's going on in the classroom that perhaps is making him have the tantrums. Because I'm usually called in when things are going wrong in the classroom. Of course, if things are going fine, nobody calls me. but if things aren't going fine, then there's people are reaching out. And so it becomes only a focus on the child to make him be happier, to make the classroom go more smoothly, to just give some suggestions. Everybody needs suggestions. Another head going in just saying, oh, this is what I thought, exactly what Jane said. You know, just another pair of eyes to see, to bat around. And then what I will always say is, I don't have all the answers. Let's try something and see if it works, and call me in the morning. And so I think that also helps to diffuse the situation. When it doesn't become, I know better than you, that's not what it's about. It's to help this kid learn and ultimately gain the skills you want them to gain.
Is compromise a dirty word when it comes to IEPs?
No, I don't think it is at all. I think when, you know, one thing that I, you know, well, I do encourage parents to go in with their own set of, you know, things that they would like to see. Along the same lines, I think it's important that they understand that their child's in a different situation than he or she is at home, and that, you know, I think unless they're doing something that the parent has that says, oh my goodness, I don't, you know, this is not good at all, that they should be open to hearing to new ideas. You know, let's try, like Vicki just said, let's try this and see what happens.
What if, let me just jump in here just for a second, Vicki. What if I say my child is not going to develop his or her language skills without at least 2 hours of speech and language therapy a week, and you're only offering me 30 minutes? How's that going to do anything? I need 2 hours, and I'm going to get 2 hours. What do you do?
I'm going to let you start with that.
Thank you. What would I do? So what I would do as the expert in Fragile X that the parent is coming to, I would say you're never going to get 2 hours, not in this current environment, not in this, in the state of the, you know, the economic condition that the states are in at this point. So I would have a line in the sand, which would probably be maybe an hour. But I would also ask the parent to demand that if they're allowing going down from 2 hours, which would be 4 30-minute sessions, to maybe 2 or 3 30-minute sessions. We're still giving 3 30-minute sessions in New York. I don't know what it is in the rest of the country. That the parent be given a lot of recommendations by the speech and language therapist that can augment the work that the child is doing in school, so that there be a communication book that goes back and forth, that so the parent knows that, for instance, the child perhaps is working on pointing for a very young kid, or that these are some of the oral motor exercises that you could do with the kid, and that the therapist sent home particular exercises, particular work that the parent can use at home. Now, that wouldn't work for all parents because some of them, of course, work and are tired and can't sit down with the child to do all the exercises. But for those people that can be part of the educational process to augment what's going on in the school would be very, very valuable. It would also help the child to, in fact, generalize his skills. Very frequently, you're sitting there and the parent will say to you, he does this in school. So if he's not doing it at home, then I think it's very important that the parent learn how to elicit the behavior that is being produced in school, learn whatever the teacher is doing to promote that behavior, and promote it in the home, in grandma's house, and perhaps in the mall, if the kid can get to the mall. And that also, so that would add to the speech and language therapy, and I would recommend that type of, those types of compromise. But the compromise is that the speech and language therapist who is not providing my child with the 4 times a week that I think he needs, provide me, the parent, with enough exercises to compensate for the lack of therapy sessions that he's not getting.
If I can add to that, because I know that children are in a variety of settings across the school system, from self-contained to, you know, full inclusion and everything in between, I mean, I think it would be, as a compromise as a parent, I would be, if I heard something like, you know, you're only going to get 3 sessions instead of 4, but maybe they could talk about the types of information or the types of inclusion, like the types of typical speech and opportunities to use that speech that the child might have in the typical classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they may have small group, but they're saying, you know, we may not be able to have an individual or a group session with the therapist, but we have small group reading, and we will make sure that your child is included in this to the level they can be included. Or whatever other kind of opportunities might exist, you know, from a very young being included in with kids to even in a high school level, like being in a cooking class or a choir class. You know, something, there's opportunities for speech throughout the entire school day.
Yes, and let everybody be aware that perhaps this child is working on greetings and trying to be learning pragmatic speech. And so without making the child very anxious, then everybody say hello and be very positive when the child answers hello back and says, how are you, et cetera. So that everybody is a confederate in helping the child learn to speak.
So I think the two of you have just hit on a very, very important point, which is that the implementation of the goals and objectives in the IEP do not just happen in the specialized pull-out therapy services. They happen throughout the day, both school and home, in the child's life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the parent should be aware of what it is specifically that the child is working on so that the parent can promote that behavior in many different settings. For instance, I had a little fragile X boy today, an adorable child who was doing absolutely beautifully, and the parent stated that the child he's a 2-year-old, the child has learned my backpack. So he's learned the concept of possession. And which is very exciting. And so now other people should know about it, grandparents should know about it, siblings should know about it, so that when the child is asking for something or when the child is indicating something, they know to promote and to reinforce possession. And then it can be generalized out to, for instance, other things, so my shoes and my fork. And so we're getting the concept of possession, and we can begin to both reinforce it and generalize it out. And that also is very important. And those types of concepts those types of acquisitions of concepts should be daily, if not weekly, communicated back and forth between the home and the school so that everybody knows where the child is.
And a good way to do that it is like by a little, you know, like even a spiral bound notebook that the teacher said, you know, that, you know, Johnny did this today, and so the mom can emphasize it at home, or the mom can say, Johnny did this at home. You know, you can talk about it at school. You know, it can go back and forth. It can both, it's like the mom's not just relying on to hear what he did at school, but this gives her a chance to say what he's also doing at home.
Exactly. Plus, say for instance, it's also important to let the teacher know that if Johnny really didn't sleep well last night, we went out to a party and he ate something and he's just not feeling well. So understand that this is what's going on and maybe we want to, you know, help him get through the day. So I think also just understanding what Johnny's going through is important too.
Let's talk, if you don't mind, for a moment about transitions. Jane, I know that many years you wrote a wonderful little book about transitioning into or out of kindergarten or
into elementary school.
Into elementary school from kindergarten. I know many parents have looked at that little gem of a book over the years. Vicki, I'm sure you've been in, you know, hundreds if not thousands of IEPs where transition goals, and by transitions we mean the child's getting ready to move from one educational environment to another. I guess we could more broadly define it just moving from one classroom to another. But the big transitions, of course, would be out of an early intervention or preschool program into a elementary school program or to a middle school program or to a high school program or out of the public education system altogether into the adult system. So where do transitions factor into maximizing the process, the educational process, the IEP process? Vicki, why don't you start?
I think it's different depending on where the child is in his educational process. I think the transition from high school to adulthood is a whole 2-hour process. But in terms of going from kindergarten to primary school and then primary school to middle school, et cetera, it's crucially important to, before we make the big transition to familiarize the child with the environment that he is going to be confronted with in September. And whenever possible, and I think it has to be always possible, the child should, with a familiar staff member with whom he cares, that he visit the new school, if that's possible, with the parent in a very safe environment. They perhaps take pictures of the school so he can review what it looks like and people can talk about it. He visits the parts of the school that he's going to where he's going to be. So he'd visit the gym, he'd visit the lunchroom, he'd visit the auditorium. If they happen to know which class or which group of classes he may be attending, he visits the classroom and they talk about it. They talk about his cubby. They talk about where his desk could be. And it's all done prior to his going in. And again, I would have lots of digital photos and have Mama or Daddy make an album about it so that people could talk about it, make a story about it. Then if a friend is going with him to the school, a friend or friends, that the pictures be taken there. And so that the child becomes familiar with this new environment. If, in fact, we know who the teacher is going to be, that's not always possible, unfortunately. Sometimes it is, but more oftentimes it's not. But if we do know who the teacher would be, to have the child see the teacher, talk to the teacher, interact with the teacher before moving into the school, that would be ideal. And if the means of transportation is going to change. So, for instance, initially the child was walked to the preschool, and now maybe he has to get on a bus, or mom and dad have to drive him. That the form of transportation more times than not will change, and if possible, let that be also practiced a few times. I have found, again, with my little guys, that the transition from the home to the bus can be devastating for the kid, and that just separation from mom can be devastating for the very young one. So maybe practice that a little bit before we go to school. So again, for what I think is important for transitions is to let the child, with somebody that is comfortable, somebody he knows, visit, become familiar with the new, so when we in fact go there in September or August, whenever we go there, it's not so new that we figure certain, we get our routines up, such as going on and off the bus, and that we meet and like, hopefully, the new personnel that we will be confronted with, and that there has been a pairing. It's almost been a handing off of the child. So the loved teacher gives the child to a new teacher that hopefully will be loved.
That says it just perfectly, becoming familiar with all of those things to help facilitate the transition. What I found interesting is that I started doing that with my son starting in kindergarten and moving on up. And within a year or two, what I found is that the entire school started doing that for all the children.
Exactly.
So that at the end of the first grade year, they, you know, in the last couple of weeks of school, they would take the first graders into a second grade classroom and meet some of the teachers. And so what was so lovely was that I started doing it off just for my son, well, before I knew it, they were doing it for all the children. And what a great thing it was for all the children, not just the kids, not just the children who have disabilities, but it's for all of them. And that even included, or that even went, that went into, they did it at the middle school level, and they even, and at the high school level. So it was very impressive that, you know, the district took some lead on that and started moving towards that.
Exactly. I was going to say that this isn't only for children with Fragile X, but transitions are very frightening for all of us. And we can remember how it was, oh my goodness, I'm going from fourth grade to fifth grade. I hope I like the teacher. I hope I like the classroom. I love my fourth grade teacher. And so getting that transition, getting that familiarity will eliminate the anxiety. The other thing I was, if your child's in an inclusion classroom, now going back to some, maybe a specific Fragile X issue, if your child is in an inclusion classroom and if he has had a buddy that he likes and this child has liked him, when possible to continue that pairing going forward. It's not always possible again, but if it can be done, if there is a neurotypically normally developing child that likes your kid, and of course the children are so compelling and so likable that there will be lots of kids, that there be some attempt, if possible, on the part of the school to program children together so that they can continue their friendships until perhaps middle school, when the child, when one child has one type of program and another child has another type of program.
But, you know, and that's a great idea. I mean, and actually, that happened with Ian, and a young lady who kind of took him under his wing is still a very good friend of his, even into their mid-20s. And so you never, yeah, those friendships that they foster, you know, they can, you never know where they're going to go. It's wonderful.
Years ago, I was at an IEP meeting, and I was visiting the classroom, and this was a child, a quite impaired boy, tremendously compelling, absolutely adorable, and he was in an inclusion classroom in New Jersey, and I watched a neurotypically normally developing kid understand about this child's arousal problems and just came up, put his arm around the child. These were maybe 14-year-old boys. It was just, you know, it was beautiful. Just put his arm around the kid, and they were able to continue to do the lesson. And it was just beautiful. The child just settled down and was able to answer appropriately. And nobody told this other boy what to do. He just learned that putting his arm around his friend would help him get through the lesson. And it was just a beautiful thing to watch.
Wow, that's a great story.
Yeah, it was beautiful, which led me to believe that pairing and peers, so much goes on, and it should be fostered, and it should be just perceived.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask a little bit more about transitions, particularly where you come to an IEP meeting, and it seems as if the professionals have predetermined the site for your child for the next year, the classroom or more specifically the school. And they might say, well, yes, his neighborhood school is such and such. However, we don't have the services there. So we're going to bus him to this wonderful school on the other side of town. Is that an appropriate thing? How should parents react to something like that? Because, Jane, I think you've probably dealt with a lot of parents who've contacted you in your role here at the foundation as the support services coordinator, asking you about things like that, right?
Oh, yes, they have. That it happens, well, it kind of like, you know, I hear about, those are the ones that you hear about. You don't hear about all the good stories. But, often, you know, it becomes kind of complicated, and you know, it looks at, you know, sometimes they want to put children on a bus for an hour. That seems a little excessive. Is the other school really going to be that much better? I mean, and so this is a tricky one. You know, depending on how strongly the parents feel, it's, you know, And what they feel their options are, and kind of the reaction they're getting from the school. You know, this would be a case where I might suggest that they contact their local ARC to get someone to talk. You know, someone who will come in and help advocate for what they think is best for their child. Now it becomes tricky though, because if the schools will say, we don't have the services that your child needs, they can be met at this other school. That becomes a little bit trickier to manage. I'd be curious to hear, Vicki, what your experience is with this.
I've had lots of different experiences with that one. From precisely the scenario that you said, where the child has got to be on the bus for an hour and he's five, and he gets to school and he's exhausted, and one wonders, you know, why he has to go through that. To where the school system was willing to be creative and make programs for special needs children inside of the school for maybe 20 or 30 kids to keep them in district. So it runs the gamut between being phenomenally creative and calling specialists in to help them create very creative programs to, we don't know what to do and so we're going to send the kid away. I ask my parents, before they agree on anything, to go visit the school and make sure that they like the environment, that the that what the child is confronting is actually worth it, that it's just not sort of a school that's sort of a holding situation for the kid until he gets to be 21, that in fact education is going on, that there are appropriate peers in the classroom, that there are expectations made, and we do expect to teach the child. That for me, that's crucial. We expect the child to learn, and we expect teaching to go on, and we expect there to be acquisition of skills. And that was something we demand. Whatever those skills may be, it could be toileting to reading Chaucer. I just expect skills to happen. However, for a five-year-old to be on a bus for an hour, I personally think that's unacceptable. I wouldn't put my five-year-old on a bus for an hour. That's 2 hours out of the school day. I find that completely unacceptable. And the child's exhausted at the end of the day, and by Wednesday they're sleeping in the classroom. So I think we have to find and ask boards of ed and ask special education programs to be creative, to make something that is a little bit more that's closer to home, to help my child learn until such time as he grows up, he's a little older and he can withstand a longer trip on the bus. I think transitions, however, going from the 14-year-old to adulthood is also a very important time, which perhaps we should devote another podcast to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an excellent idea. Excellent idea.
That is.
I want to ask one last question here, as our time is getting short. Bring it back and bring it back specifically to Fragile X syndrome. When you go to an IEP, it's highly likely that the staff, though they may have heard of Fragile X syndrome, aren't familiar with it. I mean, it is, we know Fragile X syndrome is not as common as autism, not as common as Down syndrome, not as common as a number of other conditions. And so it's possible that a school may be the first child with Fragile X syndrome to be in their system. How important do you, two of you, think it is that the school be well-versed in the issues around Fragile X syndrome? Should that be their responsibility to educate themselves, or the responsibility of the parents to educate the school staff? Or do you think the specialized skills that they've developed as special education teachers or occupational therapists, speech and language specialists, behaviorists, can be applied with minimal modification regardless of the nature of the disability?
I think it's crucially important that the staff know about Fragile X syndrome. I think many of the techniques that they do learn as special educators can be applied to kids with Fragile X syndrome, but I think they need to understand the syndrome. I think sometimes it's very misunderstood. And so kids get labeled as troublemakers, kids can tantrum, kids can become somewhat disruptive in the classroom, and the teacher, though very well-meaning, may not understand that what the precipitating events are. And so all of a sudden we have a really sweet, cuddly, wonderful child becoming somewhat disruptive in the classroom and nobody really understanding it unless they understand Fragile X syndrome. And indeed, just a few, as it were, tweaks to style, to classroom, to perhaps placement in the classroom would have eliminated the tantrum. What happens as a result of the tantrum is not only that the child is considered to be less than ideal, but the child himself becomes embarrassed. He does not like to be, he does not like himself to get out of control. He is embarrassed. He loves to be loved. These are characteristics of kids with Fragile X. And so all of a sudden he finds himself behaving in a way that is embarrassed to him. And the classroom becomes a place where initially it may have been loved. All of a sudden it's a place he doesn't want to go. So we want to stop those behaviors before they start. And so it is important for the professionals for the teachers and the therapists to understand about the behavior. Whose responsibility is it? It's everybody's responsibility. It's our responsibility at the national. It's our responsibility at the clinics. It's the parents' responsibility. It's the teacher's responsibility. Again, I want to say, Robbie, you've done a magnificent job making a phenomenal number of pieces of information available. It's up to the teacher to read it. It's up to the parent to understand that an awful lot of stuff is out there and to encourage the teacher to read it. It's up to us that have the knowledge to be willing to go to the schools and say, this is what you have to do to make the kid more comfortable. We do it all the time. There are regional conferences that teachers should be encouraged to go to. They are. They do. So it's everybody's. It takes a community to educate a child. So it's everybody's responsibility. But the short answer is, I think it's crucially important to understand the child and what's going to make him tick. And it's crucially important because we want to make him comfortable and happy in the classroom. Because if he stops being comfortable, no education happens. He doesn't learn what he needs to learn.
Well, and I would echo everything that Vicki just said. I think that teachers and professionals need to know the nuances of Fragile X syndrome because while they do have the generalized skills, you know, a good example, I remember going in and saying, my son has a difficult time with transitions. And this was just in the daily transitions from class to class. And I got the response, oh, yeah, a lot of kids, you know, I know a lot of kids have problems with transitions. I'm like, no, my son really has a lot of difficulty with it. And describing some of the sensory issues, they're like, you know, it was interesting because I can't tell you how many times I walked into a classroom and said, how long's that light been flickering? And they're like, oh, I didn't even notice it. And I said, that's the kind of thing that my son will notice. And so it's almost, well, I think parents, again, should help educate. I think the teachers need to take some responsibility for it, too. But sometimes it's, you know, walking into saying, you know, maybe it's a buzz. Maybe it's a, you know, like a fluorescent light buzzing that you sometimes hear. And the parent will notice it, or the child will help the parent, you know, bring it to their attention, and then for the parent to say, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And they're, oh, you know, because it's a very interesting, Fragile X is very interesting. Little guys are very interesting, and they're so attuned to different things that it's not always easy to pick up on. It's all, you know, it's not always readily apparent. You just think, oh, yeah, that's just, you know, they tend to generalize when that there's little nuances that can make life so much easier for a child with Fragile X syndrome.
I was called into a classroom in Connecticut. This is a number of years ago now, and the child acted up in a certain class at a certain time, and so I was observing, and what was happening was the child was placed in the classroom where the sun literally was coming into his eyes. And I said, and nobody noticed it, because you need that extra pair of eyes. And I said, indeed, look, the sun is shining into this child's eyes. Change his seat. We become so used to things that we just don't see what the child is confronted with, and what's going to make him upset. And he can't say, look, I'm sitting in the sun's in my eyes. Please give me another seat. So we just decided he doesn't want to do the work. He's being noncompliant.
Right.
So to bring this full circle, those are all issues. The things we've been talking about through this whole call, but particularly in this last 10 minutes, some of these more ancillary issues, all of these issues are things that can be addressed in an IEP meeting and should be addressed. So, Jane, Vicki gave the foundation some wonderful compliments there about the resources, and I'd like if we could just take a moment so our listeners can know what are some of the resources on the foundation's website. If you could maybe help me out talking about that. Before we do that, I did want to mention that the September 2011 issue of the foundation quarterly, the Journal for Families and Professionals, has an article by a special education teacher of what it's like to be part of that IEP process. Jane, I know you've written a number of articles. I know we have the lesson planning guide for students with Fragile X syndrome available for free on our website.
Yes.
Jane, can you talk about a few other resources? And we know that our website will be changing some of the links and the menu items, so we should probably just talk about what the resources are in general, not necessarily how to find them on the website, since that will be changing here in the near future.
Well, you mentioned the lesson planning guide, and that's an incredible resource for teachers from preschool all the way up into high school. And it talks about the different learning styles that the teachers might see, along with actual lesson plans that they can use. And I, you know, direct somebody to that link once or twice a week. There, you know, it's an incredible resource. So I can't emphasize that one enough. Now, you know, another option, and we didn't even really talk about it, was there's many, many parents who decide to homeschool their children, and we've got resources on our website about that, from, you know, developing your own curriculum to actual, you know, actual lesson plans that you can use. And I tried to look for as many free resources as I could. And, I mean, I have a whole section on different resources for everything from different ideas on schooling to IEP information and writing goals and objectives. And there's, you know, I tried to put like a variety of information, because I recognize that our children are all different, and that they all, you know, there's not one set curriculum or one set, you know, setting that is the right for every single child. And so, you know, my goal when putting together resources was to keep that in mind, that, you know, the variation in children and in settings and where people live, so that, you know, there's something for everyone. That's kind of what I shoot for. And dividing the education ideas on education down by age, so that there's, you know, we've got preschool information and elementary, middle school, and high school information, along with that, you know, maybe the topic of a future podcast on the transition to adulthood and the resources we have for that.
We also have some information about the rights law training, which many parents rave about. Is that correct, Jane?
Yes. Yes. That's so another website. That's an outstanding website that we have as a resource.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you ought to tell what the rights law is.
So rights law is a website, and it has it covers all of the information and ideas behind IDEA, which is the basis for special education, and they cover information on there, like, you know, what is an IEP. what are the components of an IEP, how to, you know, you can ask questions of you can email questions, and they will, you will sometimes get general answers, or they'll direct you to places on their website. But it's an incredible website that I reference regularly when parents ask me questions about accommodations. What kind of accommodations can I ask for? What kinds of therapies are available? You know, how can I get more inclusion? How can I, you know, the list goes on and on. Most every question that you might have about education, I have found an answer on Wright's Law. And if you give me a second, I can give you the exact website.
So they actually also provide trainings, the staff of the Wright's Law, they will, they've done trainings at National Fragile X Foundation conferences, for example. So this is a resource for everybody, just to, even just to Google Wright's Law, with a, and that's with a W.
And they actually, it's all, yeah, it's all one word. It's WRIGHTSLAW. If you Google that, you will come up with that
right.
website. Yes.
Very good.
Can I be tangential for just 1 minute?
Please.
I think something parents should be aware of in 2011 is the large number of superior applications that are available for our marvelous devices such as the iPod, the iPad, and some of the Droid devices. There has been a phenomenal push on the part of educators to write really amazing programs that are attractive and well-developed. And I think it's also important for parents to understand that some of these applications, where in the past there were computer programs and access to computers, and literally computer programs are becoming passe because you can't put them in your pocket and carry them around with you and look at them when you're in the supermarket. And these are very portable devices, some of them less portable. Perhaps the iPad is not quite as portable as your parents' iPhone. But there are just some wonderful applications, and parents should begin to familiarize themselves with those applications, ask if they're being used in the school. I visited a school in Iowa, not for a child with Fragile X syndrome, but for another child, and the whole school was Wi-Fi ready. I don't expect all schools to be Wi-Fi ready, but this school was not Wi-Fi ready. This school had Wi-Fi. And I watched young kids in a special ed classroom be able to access these wonderful applications and learn. And we're loving it. I mean, this was looked at as a free time, and the free time was used in going on to the iPad and having great fun. And I think that there are some phenomenally well-developed programs out there that parents should become familiar with, and then begin to lobby for their school to get access to these programs so that the child can learn the programs. And I'd like to give one site that I thought was wonderful that I was very impressed with. It's applications for children with special needs, and its acronym is A, the number 4, C, WSN, Application for Children with Special Needs. And they have lots of links on that site which educate parents as to the types of applications that are available. They're available for children between the ages of 0 to 75. And so there's some really very exciting things out there that parents should become familiar with, and then see if they can get them into the schools. So forgive me for being tangential, but I think it's
no problem. And on that note, we are going to wrap up today's call, which has been very, very educational. And this will be on our website in the near future on an ongoing basis. And we hope the parents will avail themselves of this and share the link with other parents. You know, we've just, even in this hour, we've only skimmed the surface of the things to know about how the IEP process will maximize the educational experience. But it's a good start, and I really want to thank you, Dr. Sudhalter and Jane, for taking the time out of your busy schedules to help the National Fragile X Foundation, and you've helped many families today. So thank you very much.